The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well done. Nice to see you, folks. It's a cold day, shortest day of the year. Well done for being here. Okay. I don't know what else you'll get done at work today, but you can give yourself a pat on the back now. As I have a quick look, inside your program you'll find the little A5 sheet. What that is a part of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' great teaching there in Matthew chapter 5 to 7. And I just thought I'd just draw your attention to that. Jesus is talking there about the difference between kind of keeping rules and a matter of the heart. And he talks about how our hearts, the motivation of our hearts, and he deals with the topic of murder, and particularly how anger flows into murder, and how easily revenge is involved in that. And then he also talks about adultery, and the idea of lust leading into adultery, and how that messes up lives, and then divorce, and the way people use that in the wrong way, and then the idea of oaths, that you shouldn't need to swear an oath, but even if you do, it can get you into trouble. So there's Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount. I know. Murder, adultery, divorce, oaths, etc. Just keep that, just file that in the back of your head. All right, here we go. Do you remember last year, Mr. Trump and Mr. Turnbull both got elected, and when they were elected, they were happy. Other people might not have been, but as leaders, they were happy. Now, that was last year. Now that we come to this year, they're not quite so happy. Why? Well, there's a whole lot of stuff going on, but the reason I'd like to concentrate on is this. They can't get done what they want to get done. You know, they've got a whole legislative or a whole series of changes they want to bring through, and it's hard to get it to happen. Why? Well, the main reason is this, because the systems that they're working in are pretty carefully set up to stop anyone having too much power. Whether or not you trust Mr. Trump or whether or not you trust Mr. Turnbull, I'd say it's a good idea that our leaders don't have too much power. Why? Well, Lord Acton's the one who said this, the English Lord. All power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I reckon pretty much history shows that. You give someone absolute power, they never want to let go of it, and they'll do all sorts of terrible things, and so we've set up a system that we don't give people much power. And when it comes to Christianity, Jesus is actually saying, trust me, make me the Lord or the boss of your life. What Jesus claims is that he is our Lord, and that we should trust him and give him, or acknowledge, if you like, his authority in our lives. Give him power, or acknowledge his power over us. But why should we trust him? Matthew's gospel is written to actually answer that. Why should you trust Jesus in how you live? And what Matthew does, I think is interesting, the way the gospel writes, he doesn't just give us kind of logical statements. What Matthew sets out to do is to show us how Jesus acted, to show us stories about Jesus and why we should trust him. Now, inside your program today, I think it's on the double page inside, it's part of Matthew chapter 14. Okay, we've got two stories about two kings, about two different uses of power. And let's see if we can work out, okay, what do we learn from these two stories? And also, why has Matthew put them together side by side? And what you need for that is a little bit of background. King Herod, actually there's something like seven different Herods in the New Testament. The Herod dynasty, I guess you could focus on the nasty part of the Herod family. They really were a nasty bunch. It began really with Herod the Great, who was a kind of a puppet king for the Romans, you see, from 37 BC to 4 BC. His father Antipater, I think is the way to say it, had helped the Romans conquer Judea in about 63 BC, and then he arranged for Herod the Great, his son, to rule for that 30 or so years. Actually, he's the one who was king when Jesus was born in Matthew chapter 2. Little complicated, Jesus was probably born about 6 or 7 BC. So Herod reigned all kind of from here down the south, way up past Galilee, etc. Now let me give you some quick background about the Herod family and the story will make perfect sense. So Herod the Great, 37 to 4 BC, he rules. He had four sons, from different wives. Aristobulus had a daughter called, well, it depends if you say Herodias or Herodias. I'll probably alternate between the two. He had a daughter, Herodias, but Aristobulus drops out of the scene because his dad had him murdered in about 7 BC. Like I say, great family. I think Aristobulus was plotting something political that he shouldn't have, and so Herod had him murdered. One wit said it was safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son, because Herod wanted to be a good Jew and didn't eat pork, but if you're his son, you could have problems. So Herodias or Herodias is there. She's a daughter of one of the uncles. What happens over time is, after Herod died, they divided his kingdom between the three remaining sons. So Archelaus ruled down here in Judea, although he was violent and incompetent. The Romans kicked him out about 6 AD. Philip Herod, or Herod Philip, ruled up here in the north, and you see Caesarea Philippi. And then Herod Antipas, who's the Herod in our story today, rules Galilee and Perea. What happened? Herodias ends up marrying her uncle Philip, and they'd lived together for a while. And then the background of the story is she moves, or Herod Antipas meets her and convinces her to leave Philip. Herod kicks his own wife out, or is about to divorce her, and takes up with Herodias, Herodias. And so she leaves, born to one uncle, marries a second uncle, and then takes up with a third uncle. And Herodias has a daughter, Salome, we know from other histories. She may be the one that dances before Herod and pleases him. The New Testament doesn't give us a definite name of Salome. That's a whole lot of information pretty quick. Sounds like a soap opera, but did that kind of make sense? Yeah? Well, I'll settle for half of us nodding. Okay. All right, let's have a look. See, chapter 14, verse 1. Now you know all about the Herods. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch just means the ruler of a quarter of a kingdom. Actually, it's a strange word, but let's settle for kind of king. Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus, and he said to his attendants, this is John the Baptist. He was risen from the dead. That is why miraculous powers are at work in him. Isn't it interesting? Herod believes in miracles. He believes in resurrections. Believes in miracles. Believes that John the Baptist was a prophet. If you don't know, as we worked our way through Matthew's Gospel, we saw back in chapter 3 that John, known as the Baptist or the Baptizer, he was Jesus' cousin. He came preaching as the first real prophet in Israel for maybe 4 centuries. Huge crowds came to him, and he pointed very much towards Jesus as the Messiah. And yet Herod has now had him arrested. Why? Because, where are we? John, no, wait, I think I can go forward. Yes, you see where Herod Antipas ruled in the green areas there, and John the Baptist is baptizing here along the Jordan in Perea. So why does Herod arrest him? You see verse 3. Now Herod had arrested John and bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. For John had been saying, "It is not lawful for you to have her." So he's taken one man's wife and wrongly taken her, committing adultery with her. It's good how things have changed, actually, isn't it? It's hard to imagine that, say, if you said something publicly that was about marriage or morality that powerful people in the society didn't like, it's just good that today you wouldn't get punished for it. It'd be really good if no one tweeted that, okay? Just don't, yeah. Anyway, it's all right. Okay, see verse 5. What's the story then? Herod wanted to kill John, but he was afraid of the people because they considered John a prophet. So he's arrested him, but kind of doesn't know what to do with him. On Herod's birthday, the daughter of Herodias danced for the guests and pleased Herod so much that he promised, note, with an oath, to give her whatever she asked. Mark's gospel gives a little more, a little extra colour, and talks about the mother-in-law. So Herodias, she's the one, the mother of the girl who danced. Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him, but she was not able to, because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him. So Herod had this kind of ambiguous relationship with John. He didn't know quite what to do with John. But he makes this promise. And you see verse 8, what happens? Well, Herodias uses this, grabs the chance to sort John out. Verse 8, prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist." The king was distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he ordered that her request be granted. And had John beheaded in the prison. His head was brought in on a platter and given to the girl, who carried it to her mother. John's disciples came and took his body and buried it. Then they went and told Jesus. Now it's worth wondering, when you get a story like this in the New Testament, did it happen? Well, wherever we can, it's good to cross-reference. What does the New Testament say? And then what do other histories say when they mention the same kind of people, the same incident? Well, this incident is mentioned exactly, or very, very close, in the writings of Josephus. Josephus, not a Christian. He was a well-born and highly educated Jewish man who fought in the Jewish wars against Rome. In about the year 70, he was captured and decided to change sides. And then he wrote a massive history, three big books, about a history of the Jewish people, but with a subtext, "Don't upset Rome." So Josephus writes about this particular incident. The background of it, you can look it up. If you just Google this about John the Baptist, Herod and Josephus, it's in his book Antiquities. If we go back, you see the gold area here. That's the kingdom of Petra. And Aretas, who was the king at the time, gave his daughter to Herod Antipas, and they kind of marry for political reasons. And Herod Antipas had been married to her for some time, but then kind of has a, how would we put it? Let's put it there, falls in love with, inverted commas, Herodias, and decides he's going to divorce Aretas' daughter. We never find out her name, by the way. Herod doesn't know it, but Aretas' daughter finds out about this, arranges to travel right down here to Machaerus, and then eventually, without Herod knowing, does the bolt across the desert to where her dad is and tells Dad what's going on. It's hard to know whether it's an excuse or not, but then Dad ends up in a war with Herod, and Herod's army is destroyed, and there's border fighting and that sort of thing. Now, here's what Josephus tells us. Now, some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God and was a very just punishment for what he did against John called the Baptist. For Herod had him killed. Although he was a good man and had urged the Jews to exert themselves to virtue, both as to justice towards one another and reverence towards God, and having done so, to join together in washing. The idea of baptism as a symbol of asking God to wash you clean. And when others massed about him, for they were very greatly moved by his words, Herod, who feared that such a strong influence over the people might carry to a revolt, for they seemed ready to do anything that he should advise, believed it much better to move now than later to have it raise a rebellion and engage him in actions he would regret. And so John, out of Herod's suspiciousness, was sent in chains to Machaerus, the fort previously mentioned, and there put to death. And you can see it's in his book Antiquities. Where was Machaerus? Here we go. And how good's that? That's the best graphic. Anyway, sorry. Machaerus down there near the Dead Sea, and this is what it looks like today. So there's still ruins, but you can see why they built the fortress on top of that hill. Artist's impression, that's what it looked like. Now, here's the question. Is Herod the worst of people ever? He's certainly a bad man. He's the worst ever. Well, it's interesting how Jesus understands human nature, isn't it? If you ever think about the Herod story, and then just pick up that little bit out of the Sermon on the Mount, isn't that whole story built on what Jesus has said to beware of what's in our hearts? So if you have a look at what's it about, that story. Well, it's about murder. That comes from anger, particularly Herodias' anger. Adultery, which flows from lust, about divorce and how it mistreats people, and then about Herod's oath. Is Herod the worst of men? Maybe, I don't know. But I'll tell you, the reason that we're afraid to give people power is power, what, brings out the worst in people. It just gives opportunity for the worst that's in there. Abraham Lincoln said this, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power." I know that's not gender inclusive. Abraham Lincoln lived in a different time. We'll include the ladies as well. But if you want to test a person's character, give them power. Why does God allow this to happen? I mean, John's obviously one of God's prophets. Why does God allow it to happen? At one level, it's the cost of giving human beings real will and real decisions. That we have real will, real decisions, and we do evil things. And yet God will hold us accountable for how we act. At a deeper level, God is still able to use the evil actions of people to see his plans come to fruition. And so I think as you read the story, it was actually time for John the Baptist to be removed from the scene. I don't mean to be callous, but he'd done his job, and it was now necessary to give Jesus the stage, the national scene to preach and so on. And so God uses the cruelty of King Herod to take John out of the scene. If you've read the Bible, you may have noticed, this is a little more subtle, if you read the Bible, you may have noticed there's lots of parallels in the life of John the Baptist and the great prophet Elijah in the Old Testament. And so John comes to do the job of Elijah, as God promises at the end of the Old Testament, and Elijah spends his whole life fighting Ahab and Jezebel. Ahab is a weak king and Jezebel is a vindictive, nasty piece of work, and as a vindictive, nasty queen. And then John the Baptist dies at the hands of Herod, who is ultimately weak, and Herodias, who is vindictive and plotting. There's just that parallel. And also we see Jesus himself dies at the hands of a weak governor who is manipulated by others. Okay, so that's the first story. Have a look at the second one. So let's see how it's different. And I'll go through this quite quickly. When Jesus heard what had happened, verse 13, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. And when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now, I'm sorry if you've heard this 100 times. I know some of you have. See the word there for compassion, okay? If you only learn one word in ancient Greek, this is the one to learn. You ready? Splagnidzomai. How good's that? Splag. What it means is that it's compassion. Yeah, it's the idea of your insides. The old translations used to go for his bowels were moved. Because your bowels, your belly, was the seat of your emotions, not your heart. It's when you get really emotional, you feel it in here. And it's the idea of you look for, oh, and that your heart, your stomach, your insides are moved for someone. In the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, that splanknidzomai word is only used of Jesus. It's a very strong word for compassion. And it's used, and Jesus himself uses it in 3 of his biggest, most significant parables. Let's see. He used it in the prodigal son, when the prodigal son's been away, insulted his father, wasted all the money, comes back because he's got no alternative, and the dad sees him and has splagnidzomai on him, runs out, hugs him, grabs him, welcomes him home. Okay, it's used in the Good Samaritan, when the Samaritan sees the beaten up Jewish man who should be his enemy, and he goes and has splagnidzomai for him and binds him up, takes him to an inn, fixes him up, all that sort of thing. And it's used in the parable of the unforgiving servant, when the king who looks at this servant who owes him like a gazillion dollars and has splagnidzomai on him and forgives him his debt. It's the idea of love in action. And so Jesus looks at the crowds, the great unwashed who've just kind of come to him, whether or not they believe in him or not, but they've come to him, why? They want healing, etc., but he has compassion on them. Then, have a look at verse 15. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote," and the NIV's gone for remote, the word is literally desert. This is a desert place. We're out in the wilderness. This is a desert place, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food. If you've ever read the Old Testament, or went to Sunday school, I've heard the story. Can you think of a time when there's a huge crowd in the desert and they need to be fed, and it's kind of like they get fed with bread miraculously? And what manner of story would that be? And anyway, okay, let's read it. It's the idea of, it's that kind of illusion that if you've read the Old Testament, here's kind of the new Moses, and he's about to feed a huge crowd of people miraculously in the desert. Verse 16, Jesus replied, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." We have only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. Why 12 basketfuls? There were 12 disciples, so each had a basket. That's why. The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men, besides women and children. So way more than 5,000 people. Now, I reckon it's worth asking the question, do you believe that it happened? Because I've never seen, I mean, there's usually plenty of food at a barbecue when you turn up, okay, people bring a plate, but I've never seen anything like this happen. So should we believe it? Now, there's been lots of theologians, inverted commas, and philosophers have their look at this thing. Here's a couple of possibilities. Joseph Ernest Renan, a French theologian, etc. Thanks to an extreme frugality, the whole troop lived there. People naturally saw in that a miracle. So pretty much everyone decided they would fast for the day. And it's a miracle. There was enough food. Or I prefer what Johann Wiese said. Jesus and the disciples shared their provisions, and the crowd, drawn by their example, did the same. It's like kind of, well, everyone had their lunch, but they had it hidden behind their robes. And then Jesus pulled out his lunch, and the disciples, and everyone said, "Oh, okay, well, we all shared." You know, that they're both, how would we put it, rationalist maybe explanations for what happened. But they do start with an a priori, meaning you bring it along, an a priori assumption that you can't have miracles and you can't have the supernatural. Why do I believe that this really happened, that Jesus turned a few loaves of bread into enough to feed thousands, and they literally ate? You can't recreate this scientifically, can you? But if you look at as a whole package, first of all, where we can, if you like, test one story versus another, as we've just done with Herod and Josephus, you see, actually the New Testament writers are writing down what really happened. Also, there's very good evidence that those who saw Jesus do this were not fools, and they believed that he'd done a miracle. Okay, even Jesus' enemies believed he did miracles, did amazing things. They just said he was in league with the devil. And so when you take this as a whole package and the effect that it had on fiercely orthodox, monotheistic, first century Jewish people, that they end up worshipping Jesus as God, take it as a package, include the resurrection that changes everything. That's why I believe this really happened. I see what you think. Okay. Now, verse 22, I'm going to hit the hyperspace button here in a second. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. Why is he in such a hurry to send them home? There's plenty of food left. Why? John supplies an interesting detail that's missing. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, in other words, this is the feeding the 5,000, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Moses, who'd fed them in the wilderness, said, "God will send you another prophet like me." They're thinking, this is the man, the promised king, the Messiah. Jesus, knowing that they intended to, what? Come and make him a king by force. They want to make him king, kick out the Romans, set up the kingdom. He withdrew again to a mountain by himself. So Jesus sent them away. He doesn't want that yet. That is not what he wants. They haven't understood why he's come or what he's come to do. Okay. time to think about why has Matthew put these things side by side? Let me see if I can show you. This is my graphic design. I know it looks a bit like I was wearing boxing gloves when I did it, but I think it'll work. Okay. There's two parallel stories. We've got the two kings, and that would be King Herod and King Jesus. Okay. We've got two feasts. Now, what's Herod's feast like? Well, birthday party, important guests in the fortress, Machaerus, all the who's who's there, the wine's flowing, all sorts of things. Jesus' feast in the desert or the wilderness, a crowd of poor people who are hungry. But what about the different motivations? Anyone want to think? And this is not a rhetorical question. I say, who needs rhetorical questions? Okay. What is it that drives Herod's feast? What are the motivations in there? Why do people do what they do? Anyone? Herod wants to be a crowd pleaser. Yeah, that's exactly true, isn't it, about the oath? Yes. He couldn't just say no to the request. He actually killed John rather than lose face. Yep. Crowd pleaser. Herod's driven by, well, let's have a look. Fear, status, to save face, and vengeance. Vengeance if you include Herodias and what she wanted. And for Jesus, it's compassion for those in need. And the two results, the innocent and the powerless are abused by the powerful. Selfishness reigns, and I suppose I should have put in here, ultimately it's death of the innocent. And here, the helpless are cared for and fed, the one with power has compassion and serves. And that's why Matthew's put them side by side. Now, Jesus is the one, in his own words, he says he came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And he calls those who serve, those who follow him, to use their power and resources to serve others. And why is it that we should trust him? Matthew's showing he's the one who has compassion and loves and cares and wants to look after people. And he's also the one with power. And Matthew contrasts that with and shows why it is that we're very nervous about giving people power because it tends to bring out the worst. Trust Jesus, he can look after us and he truly cares for us. How do people who have a lot of power use it effectively?
And who are Christians.
And who are Christians. Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'm right. Just background noise. Jesus calls, it's interesting how the whole, if you like, whole paradigm of how we think that those in authority should act have changed since the ancient world. So it's if you want the label that Jesus uses, or they use about Jesus in the New Testament, it's the idea of humility. That I will use my power and my position to actually serve you and try and care for you rather than to look after myself. And so I guess those are a lot of power. It depends where you are. If you're, the premier of the state. Interesting, isn't it? We just assume that those in power should actually serve those that they rule. And that comes from a Christian worldview. It's not the same in other cultures, necessarily. And so it depends whether you're the premier or the police commissioner, Andrew Scipione, who's just retired, was a clearly outspoken Christian, and the way that he acted and was supposed to care, and did care for people, right down to how whatever, it's hard in the hypothetical, whatever authority that you have over people or power that you have as a follower of Jesus, you should be using that to care for people and to meet their needs. It's not the same as always giving them what they want. So if you've ever been a parent of teenagers, you'll know that, for example, that's the case. What's good for them is not always what they want.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.